Episode 11 of Spinning Yarns with Nick and Paddy, a podcast created by my writing partner Nick Petru and I, Patrick McCarthy, where we'll be immersing ourselves in the world of the written words and attempting to be as entertaining and as smart-ass as possible. Before we commence, we'd like to acknowledge the traditional custodians of the land in which we meet, the Whadjuk people of the Noongar Nation, and pay respects to their continuing culture and the contributions they make to the life of this city and this region and their leaders past, present, and emerging. How the fuck are you, Nick?
Swell. Also, it's been a very, very busy few weeks. I've got a lot going on in my life at the moment.
You look haunted.
Yeah, I am.
You look like your stories.
Yeah, I appreciate that, mate.
But beautiful, though.
Thank you. Yeah, lots to deal with. Cheers. Breakups, moving into new apartments, cleaning apartments, figuring out what I'm going to do with my life, all of those fun things.
Lots of fun. Yeah. So much fun.
The best outcome is, and fingers crossed, I get this apartment right near where you live in Fremantle, sure, meaning man. That you can literally walk from where you work to record episodes in under 2 minutes, which would be tits.
It is nice, yeah. It'd be nice not traveling an hour or so to Mount Lawley, which is a very nice area, but it'd be nice not to record in your laundry room.
Yes.
Anymore. That'd be lovely.
Yeah, I'd have a little studio apartment, which would actually be a studio.
Right around the corner from the pub.
It's perfect, isn't it?
Superb.
Oof, I want it so bad. Before we get into it, we just want to say that there's a painter working on the house I'm staying at the moment. So if you can hear him like gnawing away at the brickwork, that's what that sound is. You're not crazy.
It does sound like he's biting the wall.
Yeah.
Like, I thought people paint and it was like a glide across a wall. Like, he's gnawing the limestone. Brick.
Yeah, he is gnawing brick at the moment. So for this week's episode, we've got a story, a science fiction story by me.
Sure. Was it Human Suit?
Human Suit. That was previously published in Antipodean Sci-Fi a couple years ago, I think, or at least a year ago. Got a poem about your time in Thailand, if I'm correct.
The Philippines.
The Philippines.
Another Asian place.
Okay, you know what it is? I was writing a script on Thailand today, so
all right. There you go. No, you're excused.
And then an essay?
Yes, a little essay I've written on a film I love called Annie Hall, and I was in a very romantic mood considering you're not. and I love that movie, and I just figured I'd do another rambling essay about love and my perception of this film. Yeah, and a real fucking scattershot episode again. Like, I keep thinking we're going to do a thematically tied thing, and then we go...
No, it's never going to happen.
Human Suit, Bats, and Annie Hall. It's like, beautiful.
Have you got the story ready? Let's get straight into it.
I do indeed. Human Suit by Nick Petru. The extra-dimensional spaceship sat in the blue sky over Perth City, unfolding and refolding and echoing sunbeams like a prismatic disco ball, while Steve sat on his roof, flipping it off. He sculled the rest of his emu export, crushed the can, and nodded to his best mate Poe, who reached a gloved hand into their esky and passed him another beer. Fold-out camping chairs protected their asses from the sun-baked roof, and they sucked down cigarettes and played Frog Stomp from Steve's iPhone speakers, and looked out over their city, which, like a thousand other cities around the world, was welcoming the visitors with open arms. The river and the crowded waterfront behind it wobbled in the December heat, which stunk of eucalyptus and sunblock. Million-dollar yachts and corroded tinnies fought for space closer to the foreshore and out of the westerly, which blasted through the fat pillars of the Narrows Bridge. Boat motors and news choppers fought to outproduce the other in decibels, the latter pestering the spaceship like flies on roadkill, just as they had for the past 2 months. Steve swatted cigarette ash from his board shorts and said,
"Fucking aliens. You want to come to Australia, you got to fit into Australian culture. Simple as that. Who do they think they are, coming here and telling us how to live our lives and shit? It's a bloody outrage.
Poe flicked the manual ventilation switch behind his left ear and sighed with relief. Well, they are steering us clear of environmental disaster and all that. Steve shook his head in disappointment, mullet tickling the crayfish red skin between his shoulder blades.
You sound just like one of the do-gooders, mate. You want to live with a bloody stingray, you're going to have to find a place of your own. None of that under my roof.
He reached down and slapped the sweltering clay tiles, flicked his cigarette butt into the pool, deflating in his neighbor's backyard. Poe pretended to clear his throat. How do you know you wouldn't get along? I bet if you sat down and had a beer with one.
Yeah, no worries, mate. I'll just crack a coldie with fucking ET.
When Steve was done laughing at his own joke, Poe said, Oh, serious, but you wouldn't sink beers in ripcones with an alien from outer space. You're always going on about that time in Bali we met those blokes from Iran who are, like you said, fully on point with our banter.
Yeah, old mate and his mate,
said Steve. Yeah, said Poe, cracking another export. What if it's like that with the visitors? Steve crossed his arms and stared thoughtfully at the spaceship looming over the BHP tower. A fly walked into his nose. When it came back out, he caught it in his lips and spat it down the front of his singlet, bringing himself back into the moment.
I don't know. They're pretty gross, but flaps and gills and shit.
Poe's suit whirred, cycling liquid ammonia at twice his resting rate. His cheeks would have gone red were there any blood in them. He said, Oh, you like stingrays. You said so when we went up north. Steve looked at Poe, who kept avoiding his eyes. Steve uncrossed his arms, took his pack of Winnie Blues from the mesh cup holder in his chair, and stuck his last cigarette between his friend's lips.
You alright, bro?
Poe lifted a yellow Bic lighter to the cigarette, pulled the smoke into the artificial vacuum in his suit. When it was halfway to the butt, he said, There's a reason most people are getting along with them, you know. They say they spent 1,000 of our years studying us.
Who fucking says?
I don't know. Scientists. Poe shook his head and continued. Yeah, they say they've been here way longer than a couple of months. 20 or 30 years, they reckon. Steve scoffed, went for a ciggy, tossed the empty pack off the roof.
Don't get me started on that Illuminati lizard people crap.
Nah, not like that, bro, said Poe. They're not evil.
Then what are they doing here, bro? What do they want? No one does shit for nothing.
Offering the half-finished cigarette to Steve, Poe said, Maybe they just want to do this. Steve took it, drew deep, grinned.
What, sit on a roof at 11 a.m. on a Wednesday and sink piss?
Poe took two more cans of export from the esky, lobbed one at Steve. They hooked their fingernails under the pool rings, but before they could crack them open, Steve recoiled as if he'd been watching a cop movie and just figured out who the murderer was. He snapped his eyes to Poe's and almost dropped his beer. A long second later, he scratched his temple and blinked the thought away.
Maybe it wouldn't be so bad,
he said, raising the red and white can to his best mate. Poe's suit made a subsonic whir as it slowed to match his decelerating heart. Their exports met, hissed as they cracked them in the hot December air. The end. That was really fun.
Cool. Yeah, that was fun.
That was like a little play.
We've never done that before.
Yeah.
Maybe we can do that again. I think that that one makes sense though, because it was like an Aussie character.
Yeah.
Like, I am not a voice actor.
I think you did an admirable job, man.
Yeah, admirable is like the best I would give it.
Yeah, that was great. That was fun. By the way, just to be clear for the listenership at home, Nick was Steve. That was really nice, man. You were bagging that story out before when I was on my way to recording this episode.
So hard, yeah.
Just go, I don't know. I don't know. I do that with my fucking palms and stuff, right? But like, I got a real Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. Like
Australian
vibes from that.
Fashion. Yeah. You know, this is probably the closest we've come to Australians that other series we were talking about making.
Yeah.
You know, this is a sort of vibe I would imagine.
Sort of like easy and conversational with this just like generous helping of sci-fi, but it's really mostly about the characters and their little dialogue and their emotional connection.
I really enjoyed that one. You're right, though. I was bagging it out a whole lot. It's funny, like, sometimes you think about a story and you're like, I fucking hate that story. But then when someone else reads it aloud, you're like, wow, that actually sounds quite good. Yeah. Narrating can bring new life to it, definitely.
Definitely, man. I mean, it's the same with, like, a film script. You know, you can have a script and the script can be good, but, like, as long as if you cast it really well,
yeah,
it can take something and make it sublime. But, yeah, and I thought it was great, man. You always have this really great attention to detail, you know, like, physical things in the scene. And especially capturing like a Perth summer and the way two tradie fuckwits would be sitting on a roof sinking piss. That's the Australian way.
I remember actually when I was researching for that, I was thinking, would there be a property in Perth that overlooks the Narrows Bridge like that, that two pissed cunts could afford? And I was like looking through all the suburbs and going on like Google Maps and like seeing what you could see from different streets. Like, can you see the Narrows Bridge from there? In the end, I was like, fuck, I can't find a place. So I'm just going to, it's fiction, you know?
Yeah. It's slightly fantastical.
Yeah. Rent is much cheaper in fiction.
Yeah. Well, that's just the general rule. Nice one, man. That was great.
Cheers, mate.
All right. So what's next? Poem.
Yeah.
All right. So this is a poem I wrote about my time traveling through the Philippines with my ex-girlfriend. And we had a brilliant time, but there were maybe a couple weeks we were there that we just experienced some really hairy, strange, fucked stuff. So here we go. Filipino Nights by Patrick McCarthy. My short, silly life's been a wild ride. I've vampirically drained experience dry, unleashed the gifts of my trippy third eye, and cackle every day because I haven't yet died. And that's not to say I've done everything. Never heard the bells of Sagrada Familia ring, nor witnessed a bald eagle take to the wing, and I haven't yet hiked Mount Fuji in spring. But I'll brazenly bet there's something only I've done. Well, my ex has too, but she's the only other one who saw what I saw and wanted to run when night fell on the jungle and swallowed the sun. It was 2 years ago when this madness occurred, and although some amongst you have already heard, to the rest, I swear, this poem's every word is truer than true, no matter how absurd. We were enjoying backpacking through the Philippines, a paradise replete with many beautiful things, a rainforest nation colored all shades of green, filled with a shit ton you won't believe you have seen. Venomous centipedes hunt mice on the ground. One-eyed cats stalk goannas without making a sound. Giant bees jet black and cricket ball round feast on nectar in trees where red butterflies are bound. And the people are lovely. They received us with care, treated travelers well till they took to the air with glorious memories they will always share with their hosts who made it a true love affair. And yet they must have known what was in store for us when we set sail and aimed for the shore of a place that rocked me to my core, the strange haunted island named Siquior. The Spaniards had called it the Island of Fire, where unspeakable ghosts from centuries prior suffered death yet could not ascend any higher and so prowl in the dark with demonic desire. Now upon hearing that, we really wanted to go, especially when some of the locals advised no. I recall thinking, ghosts aren't real, you know, and if they are and they're mean, I'll just go with the flow. Now we never met spirits, yet the nightly breeze pushed in from the still and urchin-rife seas, rattled the bones of the vast jungle trees, and carried into our lives a visceral unease. There was one night we woke from unpleasant dreams, in the wake of thunder, the dark filled with screams, of pigs being slaughtered by competing teams of farmers who at dawn sliced the hogs at the seams. The next day, I hurt my finger, a mere cut, a boo-boo, that within some hours began oozing rank goo, turning an alien yellow and blue, and leaving those with me unsure what to do. we fled the farmland for a different place, well regarded by other fools, calling Sikior base, where the hostess declared my hand might be a case for amputation if time we fail to race. She took out a scalpel, wielded without doubt, and carved away the infected flesh throughout. And before I could even piss, moan, or shout, she'd whipped out some pliers and ripped my nasty nail out. We stayed a few nights with the lady who'd saved my digits, and whilst there, we were so well behaved. Of her and her husband, other pilgrims had raved, so for a wee bit, we decided to put aside the depraved. Now, the hostel was an especially well-guarded one. Every night near the rooms stood a man with a gun. Of conversation between him and us, there was none, and clad all in black, he'd vanish with the sun. Yet I'll never forget how he helped us one night, when Sikior deigned to act with great spite, and deliver upon us a terrible fright that must have been, for the ghosts, a delight. We were fast asleep, my ex and I. Sweaty as fuck, the fan turned way up high, in a private dorm, windows all open wide, beneath a truly pitch black and moonless sky. When suddenly, above us, a ferocious whir, when something crashed into the fan in a blur of flesh and skin and patches of fur and bounced off my chest onto the bed without a stir. It took us a few moments to properly take stock of what had happened without going into shock, though I'm certain my sanity took a significant knock because the first thing I checked was the fucking clock. Oh wow, 3 a.m, how nice. And so gathering that, us travellers whose pants had surely been shat, switched on the light and saw splayed out flat a heaving, bloody, leather-winged little bat. I couldn't really believe my own eye. It seemed like a dream, I cannot deny, until the poor creature let out a pained cry, and we remembered that without aid, it would probably die. Its right wing was broken, bone jutted out white. It may never again with its fellows take flight, but we couldn't get close before it threatened to bite, so we had to find someone to soothe the bat's plight. Hey man, I called out in the enveloping gloom, the jungle silent as an ancient tomb, when the man in black on the edge of night loomed and with his gun slowly made his way to our room. We wordlessly communicated what had just occurred, minds totally boggled by an event so absurd. Then he quickly took up the bat by its fangs undeterred and slank into the night without saying a word. When morning came, we decided to pack, plotted all new movements and a plan of attack, for there were many other pathways we wanted to track where we wouldn't become some tree demon snack, and of satanic things there was a distinct lack. Yet I cannot argue an irrefutable fact, one that may take any listeners aback or make them suspect I smoke loads of crack, that I adored the holiday and cannot wait to go back. Thanks.
That was way better than I remember it. You've edited it a lot. I remember in the original version, you had it so the guard came and then there was this whole like conversation with the guard, but in this one he just silently skulks back into the night. Is that right?
It's because like in actual fact we didn't communicate. We just did communicate wordlessly.
Yeah.
So I think I kind of like, I don't know, for some reason I thought it would make more sense if I embellished the conversation we had. It was literally in sign language. Like he literally came over very confused. He only spoke Tagalog. We didn't speak fucking anything. I could say,
wait, you don't
yummy.
Speak Tagalog? I thought everybody spoke that.
Unfortunately not. Unfortunately, I'm lacking in that regard.
Yeah, weird.
All I can say is like, that was delicious. Thank you. He came over and we tried to explain like that there was a bat that flown into the fan and bounced off my chest. And there was like a blood splatter on my chest, dude. and this thing was in the bed, and we wordlessly communicated how to dispose of it. Like at one point he took the bat, and when he grabbed it behind the neck, the wings went out like shh, like it went out like real vampirically.
Yeah, nice.
And he brought it out to the porch and put it down, and we just sat there looking at it and looking at each other and looking at the bat and looking at each other. And at one point he like aimed the gun at the bat. And I was like silently like, no, don't do that. No,
he's looking at, he's like,
that's going to be a mess.
Should I?
He was
should
genuinely
I?
Suggesting.
Why is he
it?
Asking
yeah.
you?
Like, I don't know. I guess he looked very perplexed.
Is it your bat?
Like,
do you care for this bat?
I brought this bat along and it's sick. Yeah, he just didn't look. He looked very confused about the whole thing. And it was
fair
very
enough.
Confusing. And then at a certain point, we shook our heads at the gun suggestion. And then I was wearing Doc Martens. I lifted my boot in the air, like to like imply maybe just stomp it. And even
well,
he was just like, no.
Curb stompers.
I guess so, yeah. I mean, I thought they were just like to show off that you're a mod or a skinhead, but it turns out it's for stomping bat skulls. Yeah, so, but in the end, he literally picked it up and took it and he melted away in the dark. And I talked to the guys who run the hostel, mm-hmm. the hostess who pulled the rotten nail off me, and her husband, who was an Australian lad. And they said he would have likely put it in the gum trees that they use as nests and for feeding. And it was gone when we checked it. So I don't know if, you know, some predator
something
had taken like a cat
took it, yeah,
or something, yeah. But it was, yeah, I know, like that poem is very disjoint. The problem is I wrote it the day.
Disjointed.
Really?
No, I think it tells quite a coherent story, yeah.
Because I wrote it the day of the performance.
It's
like
hilarious.
I needed another poem for the performance at the Aardvark.
It tells a succinct story, it definitely does.
All right, well.
I think it does at least, and it's fucking hilarious.
Yeah,
well.
it's completely cooked.
Even
yeah.
funnier because it's all absolutely true.
Dude,
all
it's, yeah, like 100%. Like I couldn't.
That just doesn't happen to people every day.
Yeah, like all they can do is really just process that experience and then make it into a jingly little rhyming poem.
Poor bat, though.
I know, dude. It was really sad. It was, yeah. His bone was jutting out.
I think I would have stepped on it.
Yeah,
I remember,
I mean,
when we were in Vietnam.
There was no way.
We were staying in Ha Long Bay, I think it was. In Cat Bar Island, ready to go into Ha Long Bay. And we're sitting out the front of the hostel with sink and piss, as you do.
Mm.
And we hear this crunch and we look across the street and this little kitty cat was sitting on the tire of a car, you know, absorbing the heat, and the car started and drove off and crushed it.
Oh.
And I was like, oh my God. And everyone was like looking around. They're like, what do we do with this? And I was like, oh, okay, it's pretty obvious. And I walked over to it and picked it up by the tail and put it in a bin.
Dude. I thought it was pretty obvious. It's just,
I don't know.
You just threw it away like you would a sandwich.
You know, if there was earth around, I would have buried it and said a few words, but like it was a construction site and like a main road and shit. And I was like, I'm putting it in the bin, at least.
It's with its ancestors now. Fuck, man. You do, to be fair though, man. I mean, no, you're not wrong, man. You see some mental stuff on your way.
Fuck,
like all that stuff happened. In the Philippines. I mean, I was there like 2 months, and I think that was in the space of a week. Like we're only on Siquior Island for 4 days.
It sounds
man.
That name of the
Siquior.
Island. It sounds like something out of like gothic fiction.
It was really, Siquior. It was genuinely a place. We went to Manila, the capital city,
yeah.
And from there transited to all the places we wanted to go. And everywhere we went, like all throughout Palawan and even to the mainland, they were all talking about this place being a place of like ghosts.
And when they say Siquior, they cross themselves. Yeah. And Father, Son, Holy Spirit.
It's like, they just unleash a bucket of goat's blood on top of them just to purge, you know? But like, yeah. Genuinely, they were talking about it. And that just was a massive incentive for us to go.
I like
But all
that.
This fuck shit happened on the island.
Mm.
It was mental.
I like that you're drawn towards that. Now that
yeah,
I'm single,
so.
I feel though, before my partner was like, you know, you can't go to a seance, Nick. But now I can do whatever I want. I can do urban exploration. I can go to a seance. Like,
I love how now you're going to be like,
I
super
can
extreme.
Evoke whatever I want, you know?
Boy's gone wild. Nick goes to a seance. like maybe your ex would like go and just have lots of lovely sex and everything. You're going to go talk to some ghosts. Dude, Nick's going off the rails. Oh, man, fuck it. Just go to Siki.
I'd love to do
well
that. I'm going to and lose my mind. Eat a bat.
So, yeah, that was the Philippines, ladies and gentlemen. It's actually definitely the most underrated travel destination in Asia.
Yeah.
For sure. It's fucking amazing.
I've been writing a lot about it, actually.
The Philippines.
In the work that I do for, you know, the
oh, yeah,
YouTube
you have.
Channel at the front. Yeah. You
oh,
narrated
dude.
The script for
yeah,
the video.
Yeah, dude. Like
the
American occupation or
yeah,
the genocide.
The American-Philippine war and all the fucked things that both sides
so
did to
fucked.
Each other. It's completely fried.
Yeah, it's really nightmarish, man. That was a really good script that we did. That
yeah.
was like... We did. You wrote it. I read it out.
Well, for some context, we might have spoken about this earlier on the podcast, but essentially one of my clients for my copywriting work, they're called Frontier Media, and they've got a couple of YouTube channels, and one of them is about World War II, and wars somehow tied into World War II, and a lot of them are. I write, you know, 1 to 2 scripts a week for that channel, and Paddy's narrating a fair few of them now. Got a nice little thing going. We do that often after we record the podcast episode.
Yeah, it's pretty fun, man. It's like, it's always really informative. Like some of the only real trial is like, I guess like reading for such a sustained period of time in a narration format.
Oh, yeah.
And then like, in addition to that, like some of the pronunciations, like fuck me, some of the pronunciation we have to do, like Vietnamese towns and Russian provinces and stuff like that, you know, and like maybe French generals, and you have to just do it in like a seamless flow. That can be a little bit of a trial. I didn't realize reading could be so challenging. Even at such an extortionate rate of pay. Thank you very much, Frontier Media. All right, so we've done short story about human suit guys doing tinnies, done a poem about a bat, and now we've got an essay on love and Annie Hall.
I haven't heard this one, so fire away.
Not too sure how many of our listenership will be familiar with the film Annie Hall. It's a classic. It's a romance film, but it's one of the first films that really challenged the concept of love and how, you know, you may be in a whirlwind romance and you may feel like you found a soulmate. But sometimes life gets in the way and sometimes there's disappointment and heartbreak. And it was one of the first films ever to be so acclaimed on such a large scale to be really mature about the trials and tribulations of being in love. So I've just written a little essay about that because, as Nick says, I'm a soppy cunt.
What is it on the sop meter?
Oh, the 10? Sop meter? Yeah. I don't know. Probably, what's the scale on, like up to 10?
Yeah, up to 10.
I don't know, like a 12?
Oof.
Yeah, so it goes off scale.
I guess some paper towels.
It goes, it goes off grid. All right, here we go. When I think of love, falling in love, being in love, the myriad ways in which my silly little life has been tied to the lives of others, I tend to also think of all the pain that love has caused me. Now, I can confirm with confidence that this is not actually an original thought. Someone, somewhere, sometime has definitely also considered this. I also wish to clarify for any of our dear listeners who just found themselves cringing in wary anticipation that this is not in fact a rant about relationships, nor a mad macho manifesto, nor some creepily lovelorn suicide note. On the contrary, some if not most of my happiest memories and loveliest times have come to me whilst I've been lost amidst the passionate throes of love. And I've been back there much and often. The thing is, though, I've just used that term throes poetically, when it is quite literally how love can manifest sometimes. An intense, violently painful struggle for understanding, compassion, kinship, and warmth, where you can bet it all on someone, everything you have, everything you may believe you ever will, and yet walk away with nothing but agony and regret. That's just the way it is, an affair as bottomlessly complex as we are ourselves, as destined to cause happiness and havoc in equal measure as we are to live and die. I doubt I could have worded it this well when my first girlfriend dumped me because I was only 12, but I was certainly treated to a generous taste of heartbreak even then, though I had too scant a vocabulary with which to describe it. I sobbed for days. My soul felt ripped out of my body. And even though I can now look back on the experience fondly and genuinely miss the 4 months I had with her and her pimply, pretty face, it's the pain that lingers most, that visceral knot in my guts when I first discovered I'd loved and lost. It's utterly hollowing. And the fuck of it all is that it doesn't really get better from there because with age comes complication. You add sex into the mix, develop standards for intimacy and commitment, and pretty soon, any experience you accrue navigating the treacherous vicissitudes of love, however empowering or worthwhile, can be ruthlessly undercut by heartaches you never even knew you could suffer. At least that's how it's been with me. I've disappointed others and been disappointed. I've been cheated on and I've cheated myself. I've been so in love I felt ready to sprout wings and take flight, only for the other person to leave me, stunned and stupid, never to be seen again. And I've actually done that to someone I claim to love as well. it can truly be a nasty business. It will make you do things and say things you could scarcely even imagine. And yet, even after all this, even now, I'm in love. Her name is Alexandra. She's intelligent and hilarious. She loves to boogie and she ensnared me with her eyes. She is a beautiful, young, vivacious dafty, and I'm in love with her. But despite all that, the fringes of my experience still haunt me. All my fuck-ups, all my trauma. And there was a certain recent point when I was sure that this new life, this new love, wasn't for me. That it wasn't meant for me. That I wasn't ready to enjoy it and endure it all over again. And then we watched Annie Hall. The seminal 1977 film from comedian Woody Allen is still to this day an unimpeachable exploration of love and relationships. The acting, writing, directing, and editing are all as stellar as was raved about way back when, perhaps even more so. But it is its ending, its cathartic resumption, that I can quite nakedly proclaim here and now on the podcast has changed my life, genuinely. There I was, sitting next to Alexandra, watching the famous romance between the protagonists, Annie and Alvy, come to an end at the movie's climax, laughing on the outside because the movie is very funny, but feeling glum on the inside because I knew I was in love with Alexandra, and that made me afraid. Alvy spends the film wondering why his relationship with Annie failed, and I accompanied him in spirit, but instead of thinking of Annie, I was thinking of everyone I've ever been with, and wondering the same thing. What went wrong? What could I have done better? What's the fucking point? Does any of it even matter? I took a slow, despondent walk through the garden of my ruined passions and found myself looking at Alexandra less with love and more with cowardice and self-pity. And it was right then, at the story's climax, that everything changed. Diane Keaton's iconic character, the eponymous heroine, is a singer who begins the film completely devoid of confidence or self-belief, despite possessing an amazing voice, who over the course of the story discovers a great inner strength and sense of self-assurance. Full to the brim with mettle and poise, Annie sings for a swelling crowd a timeless ballad, Seems Like Old Times, a poignant rumination on lost romance and the pleasures the memories can continue to bring. It's a gorgeous moment, and Diane Keaton is extraordinary, her happy eyes imbuing a newfound joy into a sad and mournful song. But it's at the end, when the song is used again, where my roiling emotions erupt. A montage concludes the story, a reel of clips we've already seen play earlier in the film, tied together at the end by that wonderful song. And suddenly the lesson of the film, its entire reason for existing, becomes crystal clear. As Alvy fondly remembers his broken relationship with Annie, the good and the bad, all together at once, his sadness that it ended, outstripped by his joy that it even happened at all, I looked over at Alexandra with tears in my eyes and realized a truth that lay deep within my heart of hearts. The lesson was that love gives my life meaning. It always has and always will. I fully accept the pains that accompany it, as I do the pains that accompany merely being alive in the first place, because I simply have no choice. I will touch her hands and kiss her lips and hold her close to be soothed by her beating heart and know in my bones that whatever occurs, come what may, be it rain or shine, I know that love is for me. However it starts, however it ends, however it comes to pass, love is for me, and I am ready for it all over again. To conclude, I'll quote the movie itself, as it definitely puts it best. It reminds me of that old joke. You know, a guy walks into a psychiatrist's office and says, "Hey doc, my brother's crazy. He thinks he's a chicken." Then the doc says, "Well, why don't you turn him in?" Then the guy says, well, I would, but I need the eggs. I guess that's how I feel about relationships. They're totally crazy, irrational, and absurd. But we keep going through it because we need the eggs. Thanks.
Fucking hell, man. That was amazing, hey?
You like that?
Yeah, it really did. It's so on point at the moment as well. I've been thinking about everything in that you just said so much lately, obviously. And one thing, it's like, you know, no matter what, we still have that experience, Sarah and I. No one can take that away from us.
No one can. Yeah. I think the only people who can are you guys.
Mm.
And if you refuse to, you refuse to cow to that. I think people think of like at the end of a relationship as like a failure, you know, and it's like, there are plenty of relationships that last for a while, but they're shite, you know, and people are unhappy and people are broken and people hurt each other. And then we stay together because of habit or something, or maybe just experience.
That's not good. That's
a failure. It's fucking terrible. Yeah. It's a hollowing, bro. It's meaningless. I think if you, even if things end, man, like it was a struggle for me to do this in terms of my relationships ending, because I've had some beautiful times with people and for some reason that they ended or that they had a conclusion refuted all that, and that's bollocks. It's bollocks, dude.
Yeah.
You have to really regard the things you've done and the experiences you've gone through with this person. It's a real struggle to be with someone, and the fact that you did it so happily and for so long is a real gift, and it's something you should really hold and cherish.
And it's like, you know, I'd rather end it like instead of just like slowly wearing each other down. It's like, okay, it's actually better for the both of us to part, you know, like that to me is a happy ending. That's a happy ending.
Yeah, I mean, or at least bittersweet, you know? Yeah. Like, there's plenty of them that are bitter and they taste disgusting, you know? And I mean, I don't know, bittersweet's probably as good as you're ever going to get in this world, man. Like,
yeah, no,
you know,
shit.
Ever so slightly melancholy, you know? All things end in...
I like being melancholy, no? I feel so like if I had to use a word to describe myself, it's melancholy.
I think it suits you down to the ground. I love
standing on, like, a groin at, like, Fremantle and, like, looking out at, like, the grey choppy sea and listening to fucking, like, gothic metal and just
being a melancholy cunt. Your long, mournful hair billowing in the breeze, you know, and thinking about how you haven't fucked in weeks. I mean, yeah, I don't know. It's just, I don't know. I mean, that's like, that essay is like my best way to make sense of that, because it's still as the quote in the actual film, but it's a brilliant film. It's fantastic. You know, they're crazy and irrational and absurd, any relationship, but we need them, you know, and they're nice to go through, even if they end.
That was fantastic, mate, really. I don't know how you do this. Where do you pull those words out of? You asked me the other day, you were like, okay, have you written about like what you're going through right now? And I was like, fuck, not really. Like, I've just been writing about like grim stories that have nothing to do with me. And I sat down and tried to write a little bit, and I was just like, ended up writing, fuck you, Patty. Like, I don't want to do this and shit like that.
Without even trying, your hand just went, fuck you, Patrick.
It's an actual skill though, like to do what you're doing, and it's cathartic as fuck. Other people, super as cathartic. You said, like without the talent, pretty much to read or write, like, you know, they'd go through something like this and they can't handle their emotions, so they fucking go from a rope, you know? And like, they being able to do this sort of stuff, it's, I don't know, it's like a survival mechanism.
That's a good way to describe it, man. I feel like I just have always needed to do it. Like, I've had a, you know, I mean, not like more extraordinarily hectic than anyone else's life. I mean, everyone under the microscope has had a gnarly life, but when I think about the things that have happened, you know, some of them have been like extremely traumatic, you know, very grief-stricken, very painful, you know, when you really look at them and you give them the respect they deserve. And in paying respect to them, you know, you need to explore your feelings and figure out how to feel about them and feel strong in the wake of their passing.
Yeah, it's like the way I see it with you is like, you know, these things have happened to you, but you carry them happily. And it's not like an anchor weighing you down, like it defines you as a person. The way that you're able to cope with it defines you as a person, you know?
Yeah. That's why it's my parents who really drilled that in, man. I think they're definitely to blame. You know what I mean? Like,
to blame for my happiness.
yeah, you know, like, we have no choice but to carry it with us, you know? Otherwise you are just dead weight. You know what I mean? And I just essentially on a cellular level abjectly refuse to be. Like, they're all gonna be a piece and parcel of my story, and you want your story to be something you look back with pride, even if it's
the good and the bad, you know?
The good and the bad, yeah. Man, because like, you know, I've been instrumental in the bad as well, you know. Like, it's not like the bad's just happened to me. I've done bad. You have to move through it.
Nice, mate. I do love you. You know that.
Oh, that's so nice.
I'll shake your hand, because if I were to hug you, I'd step on a microphone cord and it would
clip. for the listenership, Nick just touched my hand with his naked palm. and it was super nice.
Slightly clammy.
Yeah, I got a slight erection.
Yeah.
A slight veil of sweat and a slight stirring in the pants.
Quarter chub.
Thank you, Nick.
Let's organize a quote.
What a lovely episode.
Yeah, it's been way too lovely. It's been like 2 hours.
For something we bagged out for so long on the way to doing this episode of how disjointed it was.
Somebody's still listening.
There was a thematic tie. You hope someone's listening. No one is listening right now. We're recording.
This is us in a fucking room, mate.
Okay, you know what? I'll find a quote right now. I found a quote. Wow, that was so quick. We didn't just pause for 20 minutes.
It happened
while I found a quote.
1 millisecond.
Yeah, 1 millisecond and the illusion's gone. So, I don't know, like I've heard of this author, but I've never read anything by him. And I do have a little bit of a weird thing about that. But this, he's an author named Ben Okri, and he's a Nigerian poet and novelist. He's very, very acclaimed. I've heard of his book, The Famished Road. It won the Booker Prize in 1991. And he's been compared very favorably to authors I really admire, like Salman Rushdie, who's like English and Indian, and Gabriel Garcia Marquez, who's a Colombian writer, and I love them, and they're fantastic. And the quote is, "The fact of storytelling hints at a fundamental human unease, hints at human imperfection. Where there is perfection, there is no story to tell."